I'd like to impose upon your patience just a little bit here to complain that y'all are still reading the chant instead of chanting the chant. So I thought I could just let you hear what it sounds like chanted rather than read. Okay? All right. First of all, I...
The mic.
I lost my mic. Oh, crank it up? How's that? Oh. Okay. How's that? Good? All right. Is it worth all this trouble, I guess? Okay. So this is what it sounds like, chanting, okay? And remember, you know, chanting is as much a practice as sitting. So it requires a little deliberate involvement, right? It's very different from just reading stuff off a page. So remember, you chant from here, right? Not from here. Okay? So I don't know if this will sound any different to you, but it sounds different to me when you go. The teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, so keep it well. Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight, taken as similar, they are not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Move, and you are trapped, miss, and you fall into doubt and vacillation, turning away. You notice that I'm scooting over all of the punctuation and phrasing? So that's what y'all aren't doing.
You're also chanting quite fast.
Yeah. It's chanting works better as an energetic practice, particularly since our basic practice of sitting in stillness is very yin. If you know the yin and yang distribution, sitting in stillness has a yang aspect. Which is very, very carefully cultivated. Namely, you don't sit like this, because that's too yin, right? So we sit like this, which adds a yang element to what is otherwise a very yin practice. Okay, so if chanting is too slow, then the yin starts to dominate, right? So a brisk pace is actually more helpful as a contrast to our sitting in stillness. Okay. But the critical point is, breathe right when you think you ordinarily wouldn't, namely in the middle of a sentence, not at commas or periods, or when the phrasing seems to suggest it. Okay, so for instance, with causal conditions, comma, time and season, no. With causal conditions, time and season, quiescently it shines bright. Okay? So, thank you for your patience, and give that a shot next time. Sure. And boy, I really don't like this translation, but you know, I'm just visiting. So, any of you who want to, we have a really neat translation at Harper Street we use, and if you'll let me know, I'll send it to you. And who knows, maybe it will even supplant this other one. Did someone have a question? Yes, please. Well, again, it's introduced some yang into what is otherwise a very yin practice. Do you know the yin-yang balance? Yin is very quiet, still, cool, and dark. Yang is very bright, energetic, warm, and moving. So in the ideal world and universe, they're always in balance. If one dominates or the other dominates, things are a little out of whack. So we kind of absorbed this from Chinese cosmology and philosophy, which met Buddhism and various interesting things happened. Yin-yang does not, as far as I know, exist, at least not in that form, in India. So it was part of the cultural interface and fertility as Buddhism and Chinese culture met and adapted to each other. Okay? So anytime you have a yin type of cultivation, you want to find some way to invite yang in also. Probably if you've done much sitting, you may have noticed that it's pretty easy to start kind of, I'm falling asleep, oh God. This is when yin starts to dominate, right? So that's why we have these little reminders like, okay, sit up, stretch the spine out, you know. Make sure your head isn't tipping, right? Make sure your mudra is not doing this, like flattening out and falling apart. That would, again, indicate that, that yin has come to dominate. And on the other hand, if you're sitting like this, then yang is kind of getting out of whack. So bring it back into balance a little bit. Right? This is actually very, it's actually a very helpful way to kind of look at the universe. And it gets, it can get kind of subtle. For instance, one of the images that's used is a mountain. And basically, you regard a mountain and you think, well, a mountain is unmoving and very solid and kind of nothing's happening. So that's kind of yin. But then you notice that the mountain also has tremendous expression and bulk and a kind of stable energy. And that's actually yang. So a mountain is in balance. Not only that, if you see a mountain and the sun is shining on one side, that side of the mountain is yang. The other side, there may still be snow, and it might be dark, and that is yin. Okay? And once you start looking for this, you see it everywhere. Right? So I'm just warning you. If you start checking out yin and yang around you, you'll find it. Okay? And of course, it finds us in our sitting practice. Okay? So chanting, and to some degree, bowing, and some other practices that we have are meant to counterbalance the yin tendency of everything, to get very still and quiet with a little energy to make sure there's some kind of harmony there. Okay, is that clear-ish? Sort of? Yeah.
On another topic, is the alternative your translation of the Domair Samadhi on your website?
I should know that, and I don't. It may be. The translation we use, I confess, is a translation that I and a couple of Dharma siblings labored over for quite some time at the request of our teacher. And it's kind of a bit of a combination between this version and a sort of committee translation that came forth with another version. And we sort of put them together, which we thought utilized the best of each. And then they threw it out. So it's like, thanks a lot. We slaved over that. Anyway, that's what happened. And the same with merging, what do you call it? The harmony, the merging, I don't know what you call it. Harmony of difference and equality. It used to be called the merging of difference and unity. Let's see, is that ours? Oh, no. This has a couple of horrible things in it. Like, for instance, phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meaning. We particularly hated that version, so we made sure to change that. And we say, yeah, but what we say is, phenomena exist like box and cover joining. Principle responds like arrow points meeting. And we feel that that parallelism was quite deliberate in the Chinese. So why are we skating over it and not saying it? It just struck us as weird. So now, of course, as you may know, each of these lines in the Chinese is just 5 characters. So that is, you know, that language is very, very dense. And interpreting it into a language that doesn't have that ideographic capacity is a real sweat, actually. It's quite difficult. So taking various versions of a translation, and we hope illuminating them with from our understanding and experience of practice, hopefully comes up with a version that's that balances yin and yang, you might say. Okay, so I don't know how you wound up with these, but you did. So there it is.
Those are the Zen Center version.
Yeah, the Zen Center version. Yeah, right. Yes. So anyway, sorry for complaining.
They aren't?
If
second.
Oh, if and or not, yes.
Would you be able to send them to me?
I would.
I can make them available.
Yes. Yes. If you will remind me, that would be good. Yeah. And okay, because they might be on the website. I think they were supposed to be. But, yeah.
It's also helpful for me to not imagine that I have to say every word.
No. Just the thing is, breathe when you think you ordinarily wouldn't. Right? So that means that hopefully everyone is breathing at a slightly different time. Otherwise, you get this da-na-na-na-na-na, stop, which means there isn't any ongoing unfolding energy of the chant, right? It's choppy, right? So one way to avoid that is everyone breathes at a different moment, right? Yes? Yeah, there you go. A wall of sound, that's what we're after, definitely. Now, y'all don't do the Buddhas and Ancestors chant, right? No, okay. That one is especially tricky because people very much tend to chop it up by like breathing all at the same point. Which makes it totally chopped into pieces, right? It doesn't have that on-rolling energy. So that's just another thing. How come we don't do the Buddhas and Ancestors? Just because we don't?
It's a morning chant.
Well, really, you can do it any time. True, it tends to be chanted in monastic circles in the morning, but y'all could do it, you know, if you want. And there are some political objections, because sometimes people think it's all men, but it isn't. People just think it is, but it's not. Right? Except for the Sanskrit names are gendered. All of the Chinese and Japanese names are not. So it's, as I've said before, it's surely the case that some were women. And the patriarchal tendency has obscured that, but it's still true. Okay, so... Michael, I think there's a cat hair on my... I think it's from your... yeah, okay. Yeah, all right, okay.
Very pretty.
Yeah, okay. So speaking of Buddhas and Ancestors chant, I just wanted to say a few things about lineage, which... in our tradition in particular is quite important, and yet not just in our particular tradition. Our feeling is that it goes all the way back to the days of Shakyamuni Buddha. And as you know, the story is, of course, that when Buddha had his great insight into reality, he immediately realized that he could not really convey it to anybody. So he decided not to. He said that would just be a waste of time. People would be frightened and confused, so I'm not going to do that. And then various supposedly deities came and said, no, we think what you discovered was really cool, and humanity needs that because beings are miserable and suffering, and so you should figure out some way to convey that. And he resisted at first. I said, nah, I can't. No, just won't do it. And finally he gave in and started trying to tell people about what he had discovered. And as you may know, the first audience was the five other ascetics with whom he had been practicing in the forest for some while. And again, if you recall the story, he was basically starving to death. And there are those marvelous, you've seen those marvelous Gandhara period sculptures of the starving Buddha. And all there is like a skeleton with some skin on it, right? And Buddha realized that he was actually about to die, and that this severe asceticism had not brought him any closer to understanding our human condition. And he was kind of doomed because he was too weak even to get up. And luckily, a young woman from a nearby village said, "Man, that guy looks really bad. I'm going to bring him some, you know, yogurt, something." And he was at least able to eat that, and he began to restore his strength. And that was the point where he came up with this notion of the middle way, which he himself had experienced both extremes, right? Namely, when he was growing up in the palace, he had everything he wanted and could indulge every whim. That, you know, was interesting for a while, and then he realized that experience of trying to satisfy every wish, every desire, was increasingly vacant and doing nothing for him. So that made it relatively easy for him to leave the palace, enter the forest, find out about meditation from some other people who were hanging out there, and then he went way over in the other direction and practiced severe asceticisms. Right? And in so doing, discovered, well, that wasn't very helpful either. How about a way that steers a careful course between indulgence and poisonous ascetic practice? This is called the Madhyama Pratipat, the middle path. Right? And extends to other aspects of Buddha Dharma, as it turns out. Shakyamuni started with these five guys, some of whom were very distressed when he went off his ascetic path and decided, oh, heck with this guy, he's just a softy. And they went off by themselves, but some decided to hang around and listen to him. And these were basically Buddha's first disciples. And that crew grew over time. Before long, maybe right away, I don't know, Buddha had an order of practitioners. And when someone would come and say, I want to find out about your way, he would say, as you know, "Ehi bhikkhu, come. And he would also say, "Come and see. Ehi pasa bhikkhu, come and see." And this is very like, I think, Suzuki Roshi's telling people, just sit down and see what happens, which is a good way to hook people in there. Because once you do sit down and see what happens, there's something really interesting there that you can't quite get your hooks into, because it keeps moving away from you and slipping out of your grasp. And yet, something interesting is happening, called life, right? Called body-mind. And the more you return to that practice, the more your ideas that you've developed to kind of capture what's going on are revealed to fall short. Right? And as that starts to happen, your ideas of what's happening can be supplanted by what's actually happening. And this is a very significant shift, right? And orients us towards reality rather than towards our picture of it. Right? And since we are sentient beings, our karma of creating a story about what's happening has resulted in our being born, right? Or having a body, mind, and all of that is attendant upon that. Right? So we're only here because of our stories, and our exit, if you like, from the confining karma of the sentient being is when the end of those stories is, I guess I'd say, perceived. Actually, the stories stop. Now, in point of fact, the stories are already full of holes. Right? They're already full of gaps. And sitting in stillness, which, as I've said many times, runs contrary to the unfolding of our karma, reveals those holes, those gaps. And that is extremely instructive. You allow our lives to be informed by that kind of perception, things start to change. And our appreciation of Buddha's teaching about suffering, its cause, its ending, and the way it's ending, is, becomes very compelling. Right? Now, our particular version of that we call Zen, which you could say it was kind of a reform movement, sort of. In terms of lineage, of course, we say that our lineage goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. But in terms of tracing a historical path, Zen or Chan starts to look like a kind of a reform where the elaborate philosophical and other traditions that built up, which at the root were inspired by Shakyamuni's teaching, started to kind of become this very unwieldy and heavy structure. And people who came to find out about Buddha's way were confronted with huge, indigestible chunks of philosophy of one kind or another. And so Chan was this sort of way to back away from that stuff and focus again on the fundamental truth or realization that Shakyamuni Buddha shared with us. Okay? And that is, we say, passed down from generation to generation, all the way back to 5th century BCE, where Shakyamuni Buddha taught. And he taught some people, and they taught some people, and they taught some people. In an unbroken, we say, lineage, going all the way back there. Certain scholars point out that the history of that, insofar as history is understood in the West, is not irrefutable. That is, there seem to be certain holes in there. For instance, so-and-so, who taught in, China in 700 and something, doesn't seem to have lived long enough to meet so-and-so, who taught in 800 and something. And we kind of think that there was a gap there. And we say, well, you know what, that's not how we tell the story. And stories are something that human beings create not in disrespect of history, but in acknowledgement that there is a parallel inheritance in this storytelling species called humankind that doesn't necessarily want to limit itself to inscriptions on rocks and writings on scrolls and so forth. This is actually, that's a very dead way to look at things when you get right down to it. Now, if you're an historian, maybe you don't have any choice. It's like, yeah, you gotta rely on what the dead stuff says. It's like, okay, well, what if you actually, believe that stuff? What if you actually feel like, no, actually Buddhism is this living thing, and what you get on a page or a stone pillar or a cave wall is not enough. Why? Because the person-to-person element is missing. Now, sometimes people say, well, what is it that's passed down anyway? Well, from the Chan point of view, you could say, actually, nothing. Now that's not quite true, because a lot is passed down in terms of what you might call the physical instruction. from one generation to the next, right? Which involves face-to-face contact, where the so-called student not just permits but invites the so-called teacher to witness their life and make suggestions, make some little corrections. For instance, my teacher once said to me, you know, I noticed that when you're having a meal in the dining room, you kind of do this. How about, why don't you try sitting up like this instead? And I said, okay. So I started doing that, and that was actually quite helpful. Another time he said, no, he didn't say. Another time I was in the meditation hall, and in the traditional halls in our style, you know, you face the wall, face out, and often the teacher will walk behind you. And if you have asked the teacher to pass on to your generation what he learned, sometimes the teacher will come up behind you and put his or her hands on you and adjust your body a little bit. For instance, I have some weird tendency, something weird with my neck, so I kind of do something like this. I'm not quite sure because I can't see my back, but anyway, he came up and he put his hand there and then another hand here, and he kind of lifted my head. And this, too, was very helpful. So it's like, well, what if that is the Buddha's teaching? It's like, well, you know what? It's in there, but it isn't that. Buddha actually taught about what each sentient being's eyes can see, ears can hear, nose can smell, tongues can taste, hands can touch. And what is that? Well, you get to find that out for yourself. And the way this is taught, there is sometimes an unwelcome degree of attention from the teacher, right? Who you might say, you know, I asked my teacher to make sure that my understanding was really good. And next thing I know, he was telling me how I should eat in the dining room. I thought, wait, no. I want to know about, you know, perfect wisdom. And I think I complained about that at some point. And sure enough, he said, that's what I'm teaching you about. I go, oh, okay. I was a bit disappointed there for a while. Until it dawned on me that he was right, and that the meaning of lineage was in this intense exposure of one person to another in a story that goes indeed all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha's time, and we hope will continue indefinitely into the future until, as we like to say, all sentient beings are free of the entanglements of karma. And who knows when that will be, but our job is just make sure the next generation feels that concern, that attention, and that care from the previous generation. And you can't really do that from afar, which is causes me, for instance, some little difficulty when I realize that some people are kind of teaching Zen over the internet. It's like, and in fact, some people have even performed ordination ceremonies over the internet without any actual face-to-face meeting. And I don't want to criticize, but I do have to say I don't understand that. And I don't see how people will actually be able to find that teaching in their own bodies and minds without intimate contact with the body mind of someone else. Back and back and back, all the way to Buddha's time. Right? Now, I understand that's just one version of things. And some people say, well, this teaching is very important, so we must spread it as widely as possible. And if some people want to tune into our website and watch us sit zazen, that really sounds boring to me, watching somebody else sit zazen. It's okay, maybe that is better than nothing, I don't know. But if the vitality of lineage depends on that or is reduced to that, I think we're probably in trouble if we don't have hands meeting hands somewhere along the line. So that means that in some way the prior generation is responsible that the next generation, however conceived, it's not a matter of calendar years particularly, feels the warmth of the hands of the previous generation, right? And is encouraged in practice to the point where they recognize their own inheritance, right? Where the warmth of that hand has encouraged and inspired them to study the self to the point where the self is revealed as it is. Which is to say, there's not much there. There's a bunch of phenomena, but the person can't be found. And now that's, anybody can hear that and can respond in whatever way to that aspect of Buddha's teaching, but I don't know about you, but hearing it is not enough. Right? That's like maybe Dogen taught, that's one level of teaching. Right? Actually, no, this goes back much further than Dogen. One level of teaching is the auditory level. Right? You hear a teaching, such as I just mentioned, then you take it in and you consider it. You actually turn it respectfully over in thought. That's the second one. And then the third one is body-mind cultivation of that teaching. These are sometimes called the three levels of prajna, or wisdom. Chittamaya prajna. Srutamaya prajna, that's hearing. Chittamaya prajna, consideration. And bhavana maya prajna, cultivation. And all three of these interact to spark the flowering of a new generation of ancestors. Which is what all y'all are. Right? So, while it's probably essential to treasure this story, we also don't want to hang on to it too tightly. So if someone comes along and says, well, so-and-so in the 8th century didn't actually meet so-and-so in the 9th century, we say, well, we don't care. That's fine. We tell the story a little differently because the way we tell the story, the warmth comes through. And this warmth, this being-to-being warmth, is, again, indispensable. Right? If that's lacking, the teaching will not survive. Okay. So does that mean everyone has to go off and sit in a cave with the prior generation? Well, no, not exactly. But it probably does mean that at some point, each generation must meet the previous generation face to face and receive that warmth, right? Receive that visceral encouragement for their own practice. Because without that, something's going to get off track, right? And we're going to wind up, as some of the Chanists complained, with folks who only really learned the letter. The spirit was not actually alive in them. Now, it's easy to complain about others that way, but I think some of the Chan people had a point that, you know, they'd go and hear somebody talk about the, I don't know, Diamond Sutra, something, and it was very not warm. It was very dry and sort of plodding and didn't seem to say anything about the lives of the audience. They couldn't connect it with their own heart. And some of the Chanists said, then something's wrong. If they can't feel their own heartbeat in that teaching, something's wrong. So sometimes they were ruder than that, but okay, that's all right. That was basically the message. So there are some interesting stories about such and such a teacher, like Dao Wu, who was a brilliant lecturer, but maybe it wasn't Dao Wu. Anyway, it could have been. Who was a brilliant lecturer and used to travel the country with a big backpack full of Diamond Sutra commentaries, and would go various places and say, "I am a lecturer on the Diamond Sutra. Would you like me to lecture?" And he'll say, "Yeah, well, I guess." And get up there and read and comment, and people were all like, "Oh, thank you very much. Yes, okay." And nothing happened. You know, it's like, was that the Diamond Sutra is about that stuff? And people, maybe they're even disappointed. It's like, well, heck with Buddhism. Let's go try the Taoists. I bet they're more fun. And then somehow or other, the lecturer meets somebody who was willing to say, "Hold still, get warm." And suddenly, the lecturer thought, "Why am I carrying all this crap around?" Chucks it in the nearest fire, right? And realizes, "Oh, I'm alive. I'm alive. I think I'll go talk to somebody about that. Let's see if some other people are interested in their own life." And this is the difference. Without lineage, I don't think this is going to happen. So again, you don't want to hold on to that too tight and get too snooty about it, right? Because then that's also a turnoff, right? The warmth will get stifled if you hold too tight. Just like if you have a living thing and you squeeze it too tightly, it will die. So we have to be careful about that. And also not too embarrassed about saying, "Well, the next generation, you know, they have something they could learn. And we're willing to be in that process with them, mysterious and sometimes difficult as it is." Right? And we'll deal with their frustration when they realize, "Well, you're not giving me anything. You're just telling me how to eat at the dining table. I want to hear about perfect wisdom." And it's like, okay, calm down. And then you can say stuff like, "We'll get there." And they're like, "Well, all right." In the meantime, you tell them, "Now, when you're eating at the dining table, sit up like this." And secretly, body-to-body transmission is happening. Now, you know, you all don't have to believe what I say. I'm just giving you my impression. I was reading a story on the train when I was coming up. And It's in, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the remarkable collection of Dharma talks by Keizan Chokin, 13th century, or was it 14th century, a great Japanese Zen master in the lineage of Dogen, our founder, but who never met Dogen, which is interesting because if you read his collection, it sounds exactly like Dogen in a lot of ways. The expression is different, the teaching is really the same. Right? So I was reading in that that collection, and I was reading the story of where Ananda meets his disciple, Shanavasa. And I kind of stopped on that one because the two first disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha, Mahakashyapa and Ananda, met Shakyamuni Buddha. Shanavasa was the first generation who did not meet Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni had died already. So I thought, this is kind of interesting. What went on there? It's like things could have gone off track there pretty easy because the great teacher was gone. And I guess Ananda seems to have been a fairly personable sort of fellow. Mahakashyapa sounded like he was pretty gnarly. He was like, he didn't necessarily hang out in the Sangha that much. So he liked to live out in the forest, and he had this huge mat of hair and was kind of grubby. So sometimes he'd show up for one of Shakyamuni's talks, and people would go, "Get out of here, you bum, you." And Shakyamuni would have to say, "No, no, that is Mahakashyapa. Let him in." So he was the first. The next generation after Shakyamuni to recognize that warmth. Right? And you know the story of the flower and all that. You know, it's like, that's nice. Right? But anyway, here's Shanavasa, who never met the great teacher. And he did have the fortune to meet Ananda. And so they were practicing together. There's some weird stories about Shanavasa, for instance. Both before he was born in this world and when he was born, he was already clothed in like a Buddha robe. It's like, weird, he came out of the womb with a Buddha robe on? That's pretty amazing. So I don't know about that stuff, but anyway, this is the legend. And so he at some point, you know, was a young fellow. He left the home life and became a monk and was practicing with Ananda. And they had this little encounter one day where Shanavasa comes to Ananda and says, what is the original truth about all phenomena? And Ananda doesn't say anything. He just points to a corner of Shanavasa's Buddha robe. And Shanavasa was a little puzzled by this. So he says, what is the original meaning of Buddha's teaching? And Ananda takes his robe and tugs it. And Shanavasa wakes up. So it's like, well, that's weird. What teaching was conveyed there? It's like, well, the actual life and warmth of the Buddhas and ancestors was pointed to. And Shanavasa recognized it. Maybe based on his years of practice, or maybe not. Maybe based on his good roots. So that's the story about one generation and the next generation discovering together this warmth in which all our lives take place. So I had this practice now, I've mentioned, of writing poems about this stuff, since I also like remembering the poems that some other teachers have written, and I sometimes share those. But now I'm trying to remind myself to write my own damn poems instead of, you know, picking up somebody else's. But I didn't have time to memorize it, so if you'll allow, I'm just going to read it off my phone here. I was inspired by the bouncing of the train. Anyway, you don't have to remember this, but the Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light, Ananda and Shanavasa. The poem goes, Ananda pulls the robe. All the threads of the world part instantly. Shanavasa bows. Ananda approves. Shanavasa's freedom. Do you know where you are? Ananda's approval. Who is it for? These are the days of our lives. Original unborn nature? Those threads are cut. We must sew for ourselves. Okay. I'm exhausted, so maybe you have some questions, comments. Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the assertion that we come into this world because of our stories?
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that my name is Myo, and I live in such and such a place, and I was born in such and such a place, to such and such a family, this is all the result of a karmic tale whose beginning no one can even guess at. And the fact that I at least have at times believed all that stuff about me and about others in my life has resulted in the generation of karma, because that belief was not rooted in right view. That belief was rooted in the wrong view of self and other. And that causes karmic formations. And those karmic formations cause a body to emerge in a world. Not necessarily this world, but some world. And the body stays there, body-mind stays there, until that karmic impulse is exhausted, and then it fades away. But the karma has a trajectory that will continue as long as there is karma. Shakyamuni Buddha was no longer making karma. Therefore, his life, as it could be seen by others, was ended. So he, once his span was exhausted, he disappeared. And now we don't know where he is. Some say, well, he only appeared to leave. Because he only appeared to arrive. So he's out there emanating, and we're still receiving those emanations, luckily. But that's another story. So that's what I mean by stories. Oh, good. Nobody else? That means we're all nice and quiet inside. Just some warmth there, that's all. Okay, quit while we're ahead. Thanks very much. May I...